Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Our guest is Frank C. Girardot, Jr.
Girardot. He's silent. It's a French. You know, it's like Bardot, Bridget Bardot, or a fine Merlot.
Yeah, well, yeah, and so there we go. Thanks for having me on. Yeah. So listen, this book really took me by surprise. Very interesting. I actually didn't realize what the story was behind it, and I'm still sort of in shock. Because halfway through, I didn't even realize who was going to be the arsonist.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Good, thank you. Thanks. Good, I wrote it. That's what I exactly intended.
Yeah, and even then, I just started suspecting. You know what I mean? So, wow, I don't know what to say. You know, and I learned a lot, especially about my taco chips. I remember I'm going to keep them away from the flame.
Probably a good idea.
Yeah, I had no idea. What led you down this road? Like, why did you write about this story? How did you come across it? And it must have made enough of an impression that you actually decided to write about it.
So it really, for me, it was almost two or three decades in the making. I was a newspaper reporter for a long period of time in Los Angeles. And as such, I covered a lot of crimes and a lot of cop stuff. And one of the cases that I covered involved an arson fire that took out several homes in Glendale, California. And the man that was investigating it was a firefighter by the name of John Orr. Later, maybe less than a decade later, I was covering a courts in L.A., and one of the cases that I covered was a murder trial involving John Orr, these very same John Orr. And I always thought, wow, this is a really interesting topic. But I never really did anything with it. And in fact, Joe Wambaugh wrote a book right after this trial, kind of about this case, but not really in depth. So years went by, my publisher, Wild Blue Press, called me and said, hey, we've been talking to a woman whose dad was a fireman in the 80s and 90s in L.A., and he was involved in a pretty sensational murder trial, and we're wondering if you'd like to talk to her and possibly write a book. So I said, sure, what's her name? They told me, Lori Orr. I said, oh, my gosh, I know the whole story. So I hooked up with Lori, who's now Lori Kovac, And together, we kind of pieced together the story of this serial arsonist who was known as the Pillowcase Pyro, and responsible for millions of dollars in arson fires and four deaths, at least, in Los Angeles in 1984. So that's the premise of Burned, and of course that's why I wanted to write it, because I had all this background with the story.
Wow. Now, with arsons like this, you know, and things that were going on, like in the, like you were talking about the Ollie's hardware store and stuff, and when you went through, this was a very new concept. I don't want it to sound like it's something good, but this was a new idea, this type of arson, you know, where he would light small fires in other places to take away resources from his main target, like this case, the Ollie's. So people, the cops were really not prepared for this, or they didn't really understand that type of method. That this was kind of the first, wasn't it?
So, yes, the Pillowcase Pyro, one of his signatures, not only the device that he used to set his fires, but the fact that he would often set diversionary fires. And in the case of Ollie's Hardware Store in South Pasadena in October of 1984, a fire that not only destroyed this hardware store but killed four people, what the arsonist did was set diversionary fires at nearby grocery stores. So when the fire department got the calls for these diversionary fires, they'd run out. They're out there putting out the fire, and meanwhile, this bigger blaze is just getting underway, and there's no resources to come and attack it immediately. It was kind of a thing that, you know, gave the arsonist a lot more power over his victims, because he was not only able to control, you know, their life and their response to the immediate situation, but he was also able to control the response of firefighters who were coming out to these scenes.
What do you think the point was? I was just going to, with someone like this who's planned this arson, so he's got it detailed where, you know, he can take away resources, go to his target, Ollie's, and burn it down. But he killed people in that. Not only did he, I'm trying to think that he enjoyed watching it burn, right?
Well, he got a sexual thrill from setting these fires. And it's something that you really can't discount. In fact, in his own words, he described the thrill that he got from not just setting the fires, but from watching them, and then from watching the response to them, and of course, watching the destructions that they caused.
So the death didn't mean anything to him. He wasn't aiming to kill people, but if it happened, it happened. Is that kind
of
that?
Exactly, yes. And in fact, you know, he felt that the people that died in these fires were just too stupid to get out of the way. He didn't really look at them as being, you know, victims or, you know, humans or anything like that. He just saw them as being, you know, collateral damage.
Wow. So this was I don't want to say a simple case, but it was pyrophilia.
Yes. Yeah. He exhibits all the signs that you'd expect in somebody who, you know, gets off from setting fires.
Almost a sociopath.
He's a complete sociopath. Absolutely. I mean, we might as well reveal for you, like, okay, so we're talking about an arsonist who's also a firefighter, and his name is John Orr, and Lori's his daughter. And before he became a fireman, he wanted to be a cop. So LAPD has a very rigorous psychological examination that they give. They, you know, gave him the exam, and he failed it. And, you know, he had all the indications on this MMPI of being a sociopath. And when you talk to him, as I have and did for the course of this book, you immediately find out that he's not only a sociopath, but he's incredibly narcissistic. Mm-hmm. So it's an extremely dangerous and volatile combination, you know, that I think given his also the underlying psychology of his, you know, childhood and stuff, that gave him, you know, sort of the, I guess, the foundation of somebody who would be a, you know, not just an arsonist, but a serial arsonist, and not just a serial arsonist, but a murderer.
Right. Now, for the listeners, if they're not familiar with what an MMPI is, it's actually a psychoanalysis test or a personality inventory. And it,
exactly.
it consists of 994 questions.
Which you know, and then
really
they have
10 questions asked a million different ways.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And all of us exhibit some signs of sociopathology or psychopathology or narcissism. It's just how severe it is and what the combinations are that cause you to be a bad person.
So really, it's looking for certain traits, and then if I remember right, kind of like out of your DSM, if you exhibit 3 out of these 5, then this is your diagnosis.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. And John, you know, John's diagnosis when he took the MMPI for LAPD, Los Angeles Police Department, was that he was a sociopath and unfit to be a police officer. It didn't stop him from trying to get into law enforcement, though, because he became a security guard at Sears and continued to seek out avenues where he could work for, you know, a government agency, and ultimately ended up at the Glendale Fire Department, where he was not just a firefighter, but an arson investigator. So he kind of had that cop, right? He kind of became a cop, even if he was a fireman.
Right. And they do, they seem to seek out, you know, careers that give you importance, give you authority. You know, it's like, what did we call it? The hero syndrome.
That was John to a T. He worked as a security guard at Sears. And, you know, took great pleasure in not just, like, tracking down shoplifters, but, you know, getting them out in the parking lot, holding them at gunpoint, arresting them, you know, making a big deal about it, because he wanted to be seen as the hero. And on occasions later when he was a fireman and he'd be doing, you know, routine neighborhood surveys as such, on one occasion in particular, he ran into a couple of gang members who were tagging up an alleyway. And, you know, rather than call it into dispatch, he decided to take it on himself to not only, like, stop them from tagging the alleyway, but to chase them in a high-speed chase in his fire truck and them in a, you know, an old car through the streets of Glendale and into Burbank. And then when there was a wreck, these guys went through a red light and they got in a wreck. When there's a wreck and he finally, like, you know, he's confronting them face-to-face, you know, he's like Barney Fife holding a gun at one of them and shaking, you know, unsure about what the next move to make is. And ultimately he's, you know, assisted by the Burbank Police Department in making the arrest. And the cops at the scene said, you know, that after they went through this whole process, that, you know, John just stepped off to the side and threw up because that's how nervous he was. You know, you laugh about it. It's funny because you never think about a fireman making an arrest. And, of course, his superiors were absolutely upset with him, furious, really. What are you doing, you know, making an arrest? What are you doing chasing people?
In a fire truck.
In a fire truck with lights and sirens going. It's the funniest thing to envision.
What the crap are you thinking?
Yeah, it's humorous.
But when there was an accident at that intersection, good thing there was a fire truck on hands, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's really, and the thing is, this is the kind of person that John was. And because he, even before any of this other stuff happened, people remembered him. You know, they remembered him as being this, you know, kind of an odd duck, right? You know, the imperious security guard, the overbearing fireman. I mean, I heard so many stories. There was a story about a couple of young ladies. They were sunbathing on a hot day in their backyard. Somehow John happened to notice them. And so his way of being able to get them to come out of the house was to actually light a fire on the hill behind their house and then go to the front door and tell them, hey, I'm a fireman. There's a fire out back. You got to get out. Of course, rescuing them from the fire, right? not uncommon. But he would also, like, he'd do the obverse, too. So he'd drive down the street. He'd see, say, a guy's house that had too many weeds. So, you know, as being the inspector for the neighborhood, you want these people to cut down their weeds because in Southern California, where you have this extreme fire danger, if the weeds are cut down, you know, the hillside's not going to catch on fire. So he would go to the people's house and say, hey, you got to cut the weeds. And if they didn't cut the weeds, he'd come back back and light a fire in the front yard, and then, you know, cite him for having the weeds too long.
Okay.
But let's
put it all in perspective, though, Frank. It kind of makes sense what you've told us thus far. You know, he was confronting people. You know, he confronted these gang members at gunpoint and found it a little distasteful, as evidenced by the fact that, you know, pardon the pun, but, you know, he vomited afterwards. So he moves to something that's a little more manageable, something that he's in control of, but he can still get the thrill.
Yep, and that is setting fires. And, you know, and developing a way to set fires so that not only just setting the fire, we can all go into any place and set a fire, right? But the key is getting away. You have to be, if you set a fire in a grocery store or a hardware store or whatever, yeah, you could do it. You could walk in with a pack of matches or whatever. And back in the 80s, you could walk in with a lit cigarette and nobody would care. Right? Think about it, right? Because how much have things changed? But the thing is what he would do is he would set up a device where he, in fact, it involved a cigarette, where he could light it, set it down, and be 5 minutes away from the scene of that point before the fire actually flared up. And, of course, so it's really hard to, and this is pre, now you got to also remember this is before anybody had video cameras anywhere. So you could, you know, walk into a grocery store, walk into a 7-Eleven, walk into a hardware store, light a fire. And if you looked like everybody else, and that was part of John's persona, he never really, his look was just average Joe. He, you know, he's able to do this and get away with it.
You know, but I was going to say, we all know people like this, you know, kind of like the security guard cop wannabe and very, I don't know, I don't really know what the term would be, but very aggressive that way and wanting to be the hero. But you don't really, I don't really picture that type of person as one that would burn down places.
Yeah, I mean, right, you look at that person as being the sort of protector of sanity or normality, right? But, you know, John is not. He's, I think in his head, like, if he goes to somebody's house and sets a fire in the front of the house, he's doing it to show them that they should have listened to his advice. Or if he goes into a hardware store and sets a fire, he's doing it to, like, show the hardware store owner that they're, you know, they're keeping things in an unsafe way and that they're too flammable. So that he's taking that whole security guard mentality one step farther. Not only am I going to tell you what's wrong with what you do, I'm going to show you. Yeah. And, hey, and by the way, and if people die or if, you know, it causes $1 million of damage, oh, well, you should have done the right thing in the first place.
Wow, so he's setting up the cause and effect.
Yep. I really think that that's his mentality. It really struck me the other day. I was walking down the street, and I saw a car parked in front of a fire hydrant. And I thought, you know what?
Oh, my.
Why the hell would somebody park like that? I'm sorry for using that. I know you're on the air. I apologize.
People in L.A. won't mind.
Yeah.
But, you know, I really thought that was a lousy thing to do. And it occurred to me that, you know, okay, well, there's nothing I can do about it. But as I walked a little bit farther, I was envisioning John setting the person's car on fire or lighting the building on a blaze to, like, call attention to this car, you know, finding some other way to call attention to this car parked in front of a fire hydrant, right? And it really, I felt in that moment that I kind of understood him, or at least, like, maybe what would cause him to act the way that he did. So there you have it, for what it's worth.
Well, and now half the book, or even more, a lot of the book is written about his family.
Right.
And the effect and the kind of family home life he had. And it didn't sound very, very healthy, you know, without putting blame on anybody. But there was a lot of problems with his home life. From his daughter's point of view,
excuse me, I'm sorry.
And even the wife and stuff, like, how did they handle it? Did they have any clue that this is what he was doing?
So I want you to remember that John was an arson investigator. And if you remember at the very beginning of this conversation, I told you that I was a reporter who had dealings with John. Well, most every reporter in L.A. had dealings with John. He was on TV all the time. He was always quoted in the newspaper. He was, you know, he was the go-to guy, right? Well, his family saw John as a hero. Here's Dad, you know, not only putting out fires, but finding the person that set him. And, oh, and look, there's a picture of him rescuing a puppy. And, you know, he was, to them, and there is a picture of him, by the way, rescuing a puppy from a fire that he started. Wow. Crazy, right? They saw him as a hero. He's a hero. So, you know, they held him in this in very high regard and had nothing but, you know, positive thoughts about him. Now, remember, the book's co-written with his daughter. So his daughter, in the course of Burn, you know, is sort of like journaling her life. And she thought so much of her dad that even after he pled guilty to setting some arson fires, and even after he was convicted of murder, she was willing to testify in open court to prevent him from getting the death penalty because she believed that, you know, he was being railroaded like a Stephen Avery kind of character. And that, you know, the justice system had done him wrong because he was such a good fireman and made the cops look bad so often. The book, by the way, the reason that she's participated in Burned is because subsequent to her dad's conviction, you know, 25 years down the road, you know, she now realizes that, yeah, he's a serial arsonist, he's a murderer, and he's a really bad guy. And the book chronicles, you know, not just his fire setting and not just the evolution of her relationship with her dad, but also John's sort of sexual promiscuity, his desire to control people in very, you know, what we would consider non-usual ways, his you know, violence outside of just being a fireman.
Do you think he could do the same thing in today's time, like now? Like, would he get away with the same things that he did then?
So I've thought about that a lot, and I don't think that you could get away with the things that he did now. And primarily because he lit a lot of fires in retail establishments. And one of the things that you see everywhere are cameras. So you couldn't everywhere you go, there's cameras now. So it'd be very difficult to, you know, pull a John Orr and go into a grocery store and light the potato chips on fire, or go into a hardware store and light the bedding on fire, because there's too many places where security can get a visual on you and get the, not just you setting the fire, but a picture of your face from a variety of different angles. Also, you know, the brush fire thing, you might be able to get away with that, but again, you know, people's homes have security cameras. There's security cameras at almost every intersection that you possibly could drive through. There's way too much opportunity to get caught now than there was then. And then I think thirdly, beyond that, the science of DNA, which didn't exist in the late 80s, or it did, but it was nascent, you know, is so precise that if you were to, let's say, use a cigarette as a device in a fire, the DNA could probably be extracted. And, you know, you run one of those profiles like they did on the Golden State Killer, and, oh boy, you know, yeah, eventually you come back to John. So I think it'd be very hard to get away with being John Orr today.
Yeah, you also mentioned, I remember the fingerprint and how much time it takes and how difficult it is to really get anything from that, from those days.
Right, you know? Well, that's, yeah. So in one of his fires, there was actually a fingerprint left behind, a good liftable fingerprint. And a detective in Bakersfield found it, and he was convinced that it was a fireman that set this fire. But when he went to the ATF and said, hey, I'd like to run this fingerprint against, you know, known firemen who I think might be involved in this, they said no. And then you know, a couple years go by, and the ATF says, all right, go ahead and run this through our federal database. There's no hit.
Why the holdup?
You know, I mean, because nobody in the fire service, nobody who's a fireman, nobody who's in public service wants to believe that one of their own is as bad as John was.
Well, that's true. That's true. We tend to circle the wagons around our own people, but at the end of the day, we are still people.
Right.
You know, and we are the easiest, because what's the first thing you do? I work in law enforcement. What's the first thing they do when they hire you? Take your fingerprints.
That's right.
There's a reason for that, because what changes in the academy? You don't become super.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Top in the academy, they take those fingerprints to compare with your past, because you may be some crook or you may be criminal.
Exactly. And later on down the road, if you're at, you know, you come across a dead body and you pinch a wallet or, you know, or open the safe or whatever, you know, you're going to leave behind evidence. And
that's an unfair comparison, because they're not going to need that wallet.
Well, exactly.
Some of Kevin's lighting chips on fire anyway, so he's
No, I'm sorry. We're just joking.
Yeah, of course. Right. I'm laughing too. Believe me. Because you're right. They're dead. What are they going to use it for? They don't need it. But yeah. That's a cop thing, right?
Yeah.
Fire. Okay, we're talking about a fireman, and we're talking about people who, you know, are, you know, sworn to put out fires, not set them. So they really, and the ATF, you know, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms really could not, you know, there's no real profiling going on. They're just like, no, there's no fireman setting these fires. It's some wacky, you know, revolutionary or nut job who just happened to set a fire in a fabric store in Bakersfield.
Yeah. Well, and yeah. I remember the times. I mean, I'm old enough to know that when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, you had to respect your elders. It was different. It sounds corny, but it was a way different time, and you just didn't expect firemen and policemen and all that to do wrong.
Right.
And there was a total different, I could imagine saying or something, I could even imagine swearing in front of my father. It's like, you know what I mean? The times, I couldn't imagine accusing a fireman or even saying that. Nowadays, we almost expect it.
It's a 180. It absolutely is. And so, you know, this decision not to look at firemen was, I think, directly because of that sort of mentality. Like, well, why would somebody in this position do that? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, he's a fireman. A good,
yep.
good
he's one of us.
Man. Yeah,
but let's right. let's look at it though. I mean, we're sitting here making his case. That's the perfect cover. Nobody would believe that, Adam. Look, I'm on your side. It back then, that was the perfect cover.
Yeah, and not only that, you know, he taught classes to arson investigators who revered his techniques, and you know, and even in these classes, he would say, you know, he would tell them, oh, you know, there's a serial arsonist out there who's doing this, 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 and this, basically pointing to his alter ego to, you know, further implant the sort of, you know, what would you call it, the dissonance or the, you know, the separation.
Misinformation.
Yeah, between him and the act and himself. And that's a whole other part of his personality, too, by the way. So, you know, toward the end of his career, he wrote a book of fiction called Points of Origin. And in this book, there's two main characters. One's a fireman who's a good guy, detective, arson investigator. And the other is a bad guy, a young fireman who, you know, lights fires and gets his, you know, gets sexual thrills from doing so. And throughout the course of this book, the good fireman is you know, actively seeking this serial arsonist, and there's, you know, an ultimate confrontation at the end of the book that's pretty interesting. And you know, when you read the book and you know what John's about, you go, oh my God, okay, this guy is like, he sees himself as these two different people, right? He's telling us he's the hero, but he's really the anti-hero, and this is what's going on in his mind when he sets fires, when he, you know, when he kills people, when he, you know, is deceiving the system. It's really, it's mind-blowing to read once you know about him. And he also, he actually wrote two books. So he wrote that book, Points of Origin, a work of fiction. And then he wrote a second book called Points of Truth, which is what John calls a book of nonfiction. And essentially, it's his defense against having been convicted of all these crimes, right? He says, hey, I couldn't have set the Oly's fire because of this, 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 and this. I couldn't have set all these other fires because of this, 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 and this. And so I told him, I was in conversation with him, I said, hey, John, look, I've read both your books. I've read, you know, Points of Origin fiction, Points of Truth nonfiction. But, you know, I believe that Points of Truth is fiction and Points of Origin is nonfiction. Oh, man, I pissed him off. But
I can imagine that was his OJ book. I didn't do it, but if I had, I would have done it this way.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it was. And he really tried to point the finger of blame at a kid who lived in Glendale who he'd arrested for arson more than once. And it's pathetic to read. First of all, not just pathetic, it's nearly impossible to read.
Did he really think he didn't do it?
No. He doesn't think he didn't do it, but he wants everybody else to think that he didn't do it, and he'll go to extreme lengths to get you to believe him. You know, when I told him that I was working on a book with his daughter and that his daughter believed that he was 100% guilty of killing people and setting fires, he told me, well, I'll work with you, but I want you to keep an open mind throughout the process because I think I can convince you that I didn't do any of this.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Well, you know, as an investigator, though, let's talk some theory here. As an investigator, you could turn the tables on him and almost get him to confess by saying, listen, I don't think you're smart enough to have done all this.
Well, I wish you had done the interviews with him, because you're exactly right. I think that's the way to handle John. And I don't think anybody's ever approached him in that way. Not even me. But you're right. That's probably the way he should be approached. The thing is, though, is that even with that, he's going to dissemble and lie and tell you he didn't do it. I wish I could give you a better description of his personality, but there is this 30,000 mile disconnect between reality and John's view of the world. And maybe he doesn't believe that he did it, but he also knows that he did. So what he really is trying to do is to bring everybody up to his view from Mount Olympus, this dispassionate observer and Sherlock Holmesian detective, mm-hmm. Who's been, railroaded by a society that just doesn't see things the way that he does.
Yeah, well, again, from what you've told us, it's that incredible ego that should be his downfall.
His ego is enormous. I've interviewed a lot of guys in prison and talked to a lot of guys who committed a lot of bad stuff, bad crimes. And of all of them, this guy's ego is through the roof. Just unreal as far as, how he sees himself and how he thinks that other people should see him. And to that end, after I wrote the book and sent him a copy of it, he wrote me a 22-page letter telling me every place that I was wrong, every place I was an idiot, mm-hmm. every place I was an asshole to him, and every place that I didn't understand what it was that really happened.
And that fits. How many serial killers do we know of that have these enormous egos? I mean, Al, how many interviews like this have we done that these enormous egos, a book is written or an interview occurs, and the killer writes these enormous, because the writing has got to be as big as their ego, 20-some-odd pages. Here's why you're such a screw-up, and here's why you're so wrong. And just the amount, the volume itself tells about their ego.
But yeah, oh, yeah. And by the way, this is single space, tiny lettering, no indentation for paragraphs, and front and back of lined paper from top to bottom, with just the last, very last line being, the sign-off.
So you were being conservative, top and bottom. That's 40-some-odd pages.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. He could have written a third book out of this 40 pages, probably.
Which also tells me that he's scared.
Yeah, well, you know what he's scared of? I tell you, it's too late. He's scared of losing his family, and he already has. And that's really it. He's in prison. Nobody comes to visit him. To hear him tell it, he doesn't have any money, but I know he gets a state pension, which probably goes into a victim's fund somewhere. I sent him $20 to make a phone call, and he didn't call. And I wrote him a letter and said, hey, John, why didn't you call me? Well, I used it for soap.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Sure.
Sure you did.
Yeah. Yep. He was buying coffee to keep himself safe.
So- mm-hmm.
Wow. How did you feel after he wrote that letter? Did it put you on notice? Were you kind of worried about him coming at you for that?
I mean, no, I don't feel like that it put me on notice. I just felt like, he was telling me, I'm not going to talk to you anymore. I'm not your friend. He's pretty notorious in L.A. for writing letters to people. I talked to an arson investigator with the sheriff's department who said he gets letters from John all the time. And then another guy I know, just a random guy who went to high school with John, said he corresponded with him for a while And then he told John, he said, you know, you're a fake. You set all these fires. And John sent him, you know, like a similarly lengthy message and cut him off. So, no, I don't worry about him.
Yeah.
I worry more about guys like, you know, gang members and stuff. You know, like real gang members.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. They're being chased down by firemen, for God's sake.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I guess it proves they're not as tough as you think they are, right?
Yeah. Well, and also, I noticed in the book, it's almost suggestive, or you slant it toward a lot of other fire inspectors or other people around the time didn't really take him so serious.
That good observation. Yeah. So the sheriff's department. So here's the thing: the Olley's fire, right? It was investigated by the LA County Sheriff's Department, and within 24 hours of that fire being set and burning down the building and killing those people, the sheriff's department decided that it was an accident. Well, that really upset John, because, you know, he wanted his handiwork to be acclaimed as being the end of the work of an arsonist. But the guy that did the investigation for the sheriff's department, you know, he's looking at, I don't want to spend all this money on overtime. There's no way we're going to be able to dig through all this stuff. We got to get these bodies out of here. I don't want this to be a months-long investigation. It's just easier to say that it's an accident. And then when he got years later, when it became obvious, well, this wasn't an accident, this was an intentionally set arson fire that killed people, that investigator would not back off his initial assessment of the blaze. He ended up testifying for, you know, being largely, his testimony was largely in favor of John at the criminal murder trial. But John, though, at the time gave his own testimony. When the sheriff's department, you know, decided, well, hey, this wasn't an arson fire, he went out and set a very similar blaze in an Olley's hardware store not 3 miles away from the one that he burned to the ground. And that time, investigators came in and they said, you know what? This is an arson.
Yeah.
Just goes to show you.
Yeah. Do you think, from what you hear and what you've learned when you wrote the book, do you think he was good at what he did as a fire investigator?
Yes. And by all accounts, John was a great fire investigator. If he went out on a fire that he didn't set, he could pretty much tell you how the fire began, where it began, what caused it, and he would be pretty good at tracking down the arsonist. But the thing is that he would do the same thing in the fires that he did set. People that worked with him marveled at how they could say, hey, John, there's a big fire here, and he could, you know, walk from the street to wherever the fire took place and, you know, within a matter of seconds, find the ignition device and explain how the fire happened.
Wow. So he was really good. What was it that the people didn't really care for about him that he worked with?
Well, John was one of those guys that you probably worked with one. He, if you ever watched The Office, he was a Dwight Schrute kind of character.
Yeah.
Always knowing more than everybody else and always following the rules and making sure that you did the same thing that he did, and people couldn't stand that about him. And the women in his office hated him because he was constantly hitting on them and harassing them and, you know, trying to get them to go out with him. He was uncomfortable to work with as a man and really uncomfortable to work with as a woman.
Wow. Yeah.
He was a real weirdo.
Which means he can't run for office at any point.
Yeah, no, he won't be running for office anymore.
Well, that means nowadays he could.
So what do you see in his future, Frank? I mean, what's going to happen to him eventually?
He's going to die in prison. That's what's going to happen to him. He thinks that he's going to get out. California laws over the last several years have changed regarding, prison sentencing and how long you can be in prison and what you can be in prison for. I guess there's some possibility that John could qualify for parole, but he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole as an alternate to having the death penalty. And, you know, I mean, I don't think he's, you know, he's in his late 60s. I don't foresee any scenario in which, you know, John gets out. I actually think he likes being in prison.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I think he does. I think he...
I would disagree simply on this. I think that he would love to get out. He would love to appeal this case, and he'd like to get out so that he can brag, see, I beat the system. I'm so much more smarter than the system.
Yeah, I didn't mean to say that. Absolutely, and he has appealed many times. But I think that deep down, you know, like way deep inside of him, in some part of, you know, like the smallest little part of his heart, like the Grinch, he likes being in prison.
Well, it might be a more controlled environment for him.
Yeah.
And his type of personality, he could be the head of the pack, and he's running his show. So that might be better than living in the open.
Well, that's true. I think the martyrdom.
Yeah.
Yep. I really think that's what it is, and it is the head of the pack thing. Like, you know, he ran a prison newspaper for a while. He, you know, he writes. He can write as much as he wants to. Nobody's going to bother him. He can watch as much TV as he wants to watch. You know,
he's in with 20-page rebuttals.
Oh yeah, can you imagine that? Where do you even have the time? I don't even know how I had the time to write the damn book, let alone, you know, write it, read it, and then write a 20-page synopsis of it.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
Yeah.
So, well, what's coming up next for Frank? What are you doing up next?
Well, thanks for asking. One of my previous books was written with Ken Urell. He's a former New York police officer who is convicted of... being a really bad guy. If you've seen the 7-4 documentary on Netflix, he was one of the guys that was dealing cocaine while a member of the New York Police Department. So we wrote a book together. It was called Betrayal in Blue. And we're doing a part two to that where we look at some other incidents of officer misconduct and how departments sometimes look the other way even when their cops are being really bad.
Mm, touché.
We actually had him on the show.
Yeah, oh, you had Ken on the show. Well, good. He probably talked about Betrayal in Blue, I'm sure.
Yeah, yes, that's what we talked about. We talked about that. Yeah. It was one of our biggest shows last year. And Burl Bear's been on a few times.
Yeah, so Burl, Ken, and I worked on that book, and then on part two, it's me and Ken.
Wow.
Small world.
Yeah.
I look forward to it.
Good. You know, I think you'll like it. We've looked at some interesting cases. We've looked at stuff in the LAPD, stuff in Miami, stuff in Detroit and Cleveland. So we're giving like a more national perspective. And we're interviewing a lot of the bad cops, too.
Oh, there's lots of those.
Yeah. Oh, man. Every day.
Hey, now.
Hey, and you know, I still get, I don't know, a couple of dozen of write-ups about that interview. People still... say terrible things about him.
Oh, yeah. Well, his partner sure doesn't care for him. But,
no.
But Ken has really, I think, turned his life around in a significant way. Certainly the most honest of the group of the 7-4 that was involved in that stuff. And from the perspective of writing a book about bad cops, who better to have, you know, diagnose what's wrong with a cop than a bad cop?
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, I hate to say it, but that's absolutely true. I mean, who knows better? You know, much like, you know, we've been talking today about an arsonist who was an arson investigator, and they know how to get away with it because they know all the tricks of the trade, and they're the ones teaching it. So they know where the blind spots are.
Yep, and they can influence their students to maybe not look at them, even go that far, right?
Misinformation. You
know. Yep. Yeah.
But Frank, it has been an absolutely fascinating show today. I'd like to have you on again.
Well, thank you. I'd love to come on anytime.
But our guest today, though, has been Frank Girardo, and the book again. Frank, go ahead.
The book is Burned. It's available at Wild Blue Press or on Amazon.com or in your neighborhood bookstore. burned.
And it's an absolutely fascinating read. Al, would you agree?
Yes. Fascinating listen.
There you go. It's also available on audiobook.
Cool. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and we'd like to have you back very, very soon.
All right, good. I look forward to it.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.